Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
This bill that we will sign today is not a revolutionary bill. It does not affect the lives of millions. It will not reshape the structure of our daily lives or really add importantly to either our wealth or our power. Yet it is still one of the most important acts of this Congress and of this administration. For it does repair a very deep and painful flaw in the fabric of American justice. It corrects a cruel and enduring wrong in the conduct of the American nation.
Hello and welcome to episode 54 of American History 2. And after the brief episode we did where we focused very specifically on the midterm elections, today we're bringing you a podcast where we could do an entire 10-part series on it and probably still not have done a comprehensive job of it. And to begin to tackle this topic with me is, as always, Dr. Malcolm Craig. Hello, Malcolm.
Hello, Mark. My contributions to this episode may sound slightly echoier than usual because I'm sitting in the kitchen of the house we just moved to about 3 weeks ago. So things are still in a bit of a state of flux. But yes, definitely, you're dead right. I mean, we could spend tens of episodes looking at immigration in the United States and still not have properly covered it in any meaningful way. But in order to try and talk about it in a meaningful way, for 45 to 50 minutes, we're very, very lucky to be joined by Gráinne McEvoy, who has done an extensive research into the topic of immigration in the United States, its relationship with religion and various other things. And we're delighted to have such kind of expert witness to come and guide us through this at times controversial and often convoluted topic. So Gráinne, thank you very much for joining us from South Bend, Indiana. And could you just give us a minute or so about yourself and your research?
Yeah, thanks for having me on, guys. This is great. Really exciting. And I think I mentioned to you before that I noticed that the origins of this podcast were in the American history class at the University of Edinburgh, which is where I got my start in American history a very, very long time ago. So this feels very full circle, and it's lovely to join you. I hope I can try to start to shed some light. I think what you said about how much time we could spend on this topic, given the current climate and given the history, is exactly spot on. So we'll make a start and we'll do what we can. At the minute, immigration historians are really working overtime to sort of try and, explain that history to the general public through Twitter and through blogs and even participating in Supreme Court sort of amicus briefs. So there are a lot of people working really hard on this, and if we can do something here, that would be great. My background is I got my PhD at Boston College, finished in 2014, a few years ago, and I was back in my, obviously not from South Bend, Indiana, I was back in my home country of Ireland and did a postdoc at Trinity a couple of years ago. And I work on Catholic social thought and immigration policy in the 20th century. So I really look at the period from around the 1910s when we start to see fairly extensive immigration restrictions introduced. We don't start to see them there, but what we're going to get to that, up until 1965 to the Immigration Reform Act of Hart-Celler. And I really look at how Catholic immigration experts, social theorists, others, try to participate in the debate around immigration during that period. Because really, that period, although we have those restrictions in place, was a whole process of reforming immigration constantly. So that's what I work on, and hopefully we can talk a bit more about that as we go on.
I think we definitely shall. but before we get there, and to make this big topic somewhat more manageable, we're going to mostly be focusing on the sort of 20th century period, and specifically the era that you outlined. But to give you a little bit of a challenge before we get there, I was hoping you might be able to give our listeners a sense of, you know, what was US immigration policy like before the 20th century? What were the main kind of parameters that were going on there for you to be allowed to come to the United States and stay in, say, from the Civil War onwards?
Right. So, I mean, the short answer is for the majority of people who were coming in, there weren't very many parameters. May Nye is, you know, probably one of the most well-known historians of immigration writing at the minute, and she's explained this as the introduction of the laws in the 1920s that we're going to talk about transformed US policy from normatively open to normatively closed. So, you know, what she says there is, for the 19th century, unless you fell within specific excludable categories, so we'll get to some of those, as an immigrant, you can more or less assume that you'll be granted permission to enter. Now, you're going to have to go through health inspections. There's some other checks. We've all seen The Godfather Part 2, where little Vito Corleone made his way through Ellis Island. That's a little bit later. But you know, in general, there were no visas. There were no passports. You didn't have to go to the London consulate for an interview like I did this time last year in the cold weather. So generally, for most people, it wasn't... there were no major restrictions in immigration. Now there are significant and really important exceptions to that. The most important one, which I know you've already discussed in the series, was the Chinese Exclusion Act and the exclusion of basically Chinese laborers, but that's going to cover most Chinese people. From 1882, there was the Page Act before that affected Chinese women. So that's the biggest exception, but I won't say too much about that because I know you've discussed that before. And then there were other restrictions brought in a couple of federal immigration acts in 1882 and 1891. And those laws were designed to centralize immigration control within the federal government rather than at the state level, which had been the case before. And what they did in terms of how that would affect whether you could come in or not was they introduced excludable classes like criminals, prostitutes, people with mental illness, those likely to become a public charge, which is an important one, which is going to come up again and again, felons, polygamists, other groups, and those suffering from contagious diseases, right, which is why Vito Corleone gets his eyelids checked or whatever it is they're doing to check for eye disease. So those restrictions were in place. And just one other note, and because I have some good friends and colleagues who worked on this project, on this topic, before even Chinese exclusion, we did see state level restrictions before the federal government really took sort of centralized control of immigration policy. And these were based on colonial per laws that allowed the state to remove a person if they become a burden on the state. And so this affected people in Massachusetts and New York. It was a sort of formative stage in the history of deportation law, and it also helped establish some parameters for immigration restriction at the federal level. So that's what we're talking about in the 19th century. And in terms of the people who came, like, you know, a lot of your listeners are probably aware of the significant numbers of Irish who migrated, especially after the famine, but then, you know, throughout the 19th century. Germans were the major European group to migrate in those middle decades of the 19th century, sorry. Chinese immigrants up until exclusion came in significant numbers to the West Coast. And then from the 1890s, and we're going to talk a lot about this, I know, we start to see a change, a shift towards immigration from Southern and Eastern Europe. So migrants from Italy in particular, the Russian Empire, so Poles, Czechs, Slovaks, Greeks, Romanians. And these groups of people took up about 70% of the flow from the 1890s onwards. So that's a significant shift, which is really going to affect how immigration law changes.
A term that seems to be kind of is bandied about a lot regarding US immigration in this time is the idea of the melting pot. the United States as this melting pot. I wonder if you could talk briefly, what did the idea of the melting pot mean to people in the late 19th and early 20th century?
Yeah, so the melting pot, I mean, to some people it was a pejorative, to some people it was a good thing, a benefit. It's very hard to trace the origins of some of these terms, but the melting pot seems to have emerged really amongst immigrants themselves, in maybe as early as the mid 19th century. And German Americans especially talked about it as a sort of positive, right? A goal, an ongoing process. And the idea was America is this crucible. And it's a crucible, it's a pot that works to amalgamate immigrants' best traits into this new American identity. So that's a very positive thing, right? This idea that it takes the best from immigrants. And we still hear this rhetoric today. We get into the late 19th century and optimism about the power of the melting pot begins to waver, especially amongst those who are watching this influx of immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe with trepidation. There's a concern that the melting pot just isn't going to be strong enough to melt away the multiplicity of languages. There's so many Catholics and Jewish people in this group. They look very different to immigrants that had been coming beforehand. All of these, this extra foreignness seems to be too much of a threat to the melting pot, as well as the sheer volume of people coming in. So, and then of course, as you probably know, we see the sort of emergence of race science, social science, towards the end of the 19th century, that's going to have a significant effect on how immigration law will be reshaped. And they're expressing concerns about the power of the melting pot. But at the same time, we still have, it retains a sort of potency amongst progressives and social reformers around the turn of the century. Now, probably one of the most, well-known, but definitely used by immigration historians in teaching sort of images of the melting pot is there's a great photograph of Henry Ford's English school, the graduates of Henry Ford's English school, literally marching into a massive pot, and they're all dressed in their supposedly, you know, their native clothes from whatever country they came from. I'm not sure if the people wearing the clothes actually were from those countries, probably not. And then they march into the melting pot and emerge in, you know, American clothes, waving American flags. So this is this very visual representation of the melting pot. And it's seen as a positive thing by the likes of Henry Ford, but also by other, you know, progressives and social reformers who want to smooth the way for assimilation for these new immigrants. But I would just add, just because of my own research, amongst Catholic critics at the time, Catholic bishops, the melting pot was also viewed as potentially a coercive assimilation. They were very concerned about this sort of Protestant tinge to the melting pot, a melting pot controlled by Anglo-Americans. And so Catholic groups, and this may have been true of other groups that were perhaps outside of that Anglo-American core, were very concerned that the melting pot was too coercive. So I hope that sort of gets at that term.
Yeah, definitely. And just as a quick follow-up, in terms of when you're mentioning the sort of the beginnings of the fears around immigrants that, you know, start in the 1890s, specific, or ramp up in the 1890s, I was just wondering, just purely because it's sort of something that's talked about a lot just now, is this a case where, you know, often you've got the immigrants flooding into the city, I probably shouldn't use the word flooding, immigrants going into the cities, I mean, today you've got sort of, it seems to be the people that fear immigrants the most are the ones that don't have any contact with them in terms of, in that way. And I was wondering, in terms of people living in rural areas where are generally quite white and homogenous areas, is it the same back at this time, or is it people that don't have that much contact with the immigrants that fear them, or is it the people that are living in, say, for example, New York, Boston, and are like, oh my God, these people are cramping our style,
yeah,
or whatever,
yeah,
you know?
It's a really good question. And I'm not sure. I think probably because that a lot of the material we have, the evidence we have that, you know, records feelings and views on the immigrants is made, a lot of what I would work with is made by first-hand observers, you know, so They would have been in some of the sort of northeast cities that we think about when we think about these European immigrants. But it's a good question because, you know, if we look at sort of immigrants, you know, maybe in the Midwest, the difference there is that the rates of they're generally doing better in places like that. I mean, that's part of that. It's part of why they're going to places like Chicago, St. Louis, and some of these new cities that are opening up in the Midwest. And so I think perhaps the argument could be made that people who are living in, not that the Midwest was necessarily totally rural then, but people who are living in less populated parts of the country were coming into contact with immigrants who were generally faring better. So it's a really good question. I don't know if I have a very good answer to it, but that's just my thought in response to that.
So we've done quite, and it's interesting you point out, kind of, you know, the rise of kind of, you know, racial science and all of this thing that's happening at the same time as this significant immigration to the United States. And we've done quite a few episodes, you know, discussing the early 20th century. And one thing that comes up again and again and again is just how racist this period in American history is, even by the standards of some other really racist periods in U.S. history. So we've, I mean, for, you know, the revival of the KKK and how the KKK targets ethnic groups beyond African Americans. We've discussed anti-Asian sentiment, like the Chinese Exclusion Act and the so-called Gentleman's Agreement that takes place with Japan and all these other things that are going on. Does racism, and in whatever form it takes, and anti-immigrant settlement, is that targeted at all ethnic groups coming to the US, or is there a specific focus to the distrust and dislike and sometimes overt hatred of immigrants?
Yeah, I mean, I think by the time we get to the early 20th century, a lot of this anti-immigrant sentiment is really directed against Southern and Eastern Europeans. Now, of course, the caveat there is that Chinese exclusion and other Asian groups are progressively being, you know, legislated against, right? So the Gentleman's Agreement, I know you've talked about before, with Japan. So I don't want to suggest that Europeans are the only people on the, obviously, receiving this anti-immigrant sentiment. That's clearly wrong. But the focus of a lot of immigration proponents of immigration restriction at the sort of general federal level, their focus really at this point had turned to these Southern and Eastern Europeans. And they were trying to figure out a way to do that because they're not Asians. They're not, you know, these people are European. They're from the same sort of continental landmass as, you know, the ancestors of the likes of Henry Cabot Lodge, right? The senator from Massachusetts, who's a big mover and shaker in the, this restriction movement. But they still see them as different, right? They still see them as, you know, they're Catholic, they're Jewish, their skin tone slightly different, all of those things. And there was a sense of a racial difference. But it's how to put that into legislation is what really bothers them. So, one thing that, really becomes a focus is a literacy test act. And so it's, the literacy test act is, you know, the idea is you can't be admitted if you're illiterate. At one point it was if you were illiterate in English, which was obviously going to be a very hard bar to reach for most of these immigrants, but then that was changed to one's native language. And it takes a long time to introduce this, but it's clearly a placeholder for trying to reduce migration from Southern and Eastern Europe because the people, those who put it together knew that literacy rates in those parts of Europe were lower than Northern and Western Europe. So that tells us that those Europeans from that part of Europe were the focus of much of this anti-immigrant sentiment. Now, one thing I would say too is that I always find it really important, and it's really important today and historically and in how we view our history, to parse out the difference between sentiment and the enactment of policy, because, you know, we know that the Irish in the 19th century, even into the 20th century, were subject to anti-immigrant, anti-Irish nativism. We know that in the mid-19th century, but they were never subjected to exclusion on the basis of their national origins or their race in the way that Chinese or other groups were. So I really like this question, and you can see I'm sort of veering into the policy side of things because that's usually where I focus. But I think talking about anti-immigrant sentiment is really important to measure the tone. And, you know, we hear a lot about the chilling effect of what the Trump administration is doing today. And I think that was probably true of the period we're talking about. But what I'm interested in too is where sentiment turns into actual policy and legislation that affects people's lives.
Well, I'm glad you said that. That's a wonderful transition, because I wanted to nudge you along to the sort of the whopping big policy change that occurs in US immigration policy, first tentatively in 1921, and then finally put in stone with the sort of Immigration Act of 1924. So I was wondering, what were the sort of, you mentioned that before we recorded, there's some really interesting weeds in this discussion, but first of all, what were the sort of big headline measures? You know, what does the Immigration Act of 1924 do?
Yeah, so the Immigration Act of 1924, Reed Johnson, we know, we always give, you know, we think about these immigration acts with their names of their legislators. The main thing it does, I have to commit to one, it was the first permanent cap on immigration, upper level cap on immigration. And that's just a really important concept to think about, because for the first time for American immigration, there's a limit to the number of people who can come in. Whereas beforehand, nothing like that existed. Now, that excludes the Western Hemisphere, right? So the Western Hemisphere, there's no limit to the number of people who can come in from there. And that's for obvious reasons to do with diplomacy and then obviously the labor supply that they want to keep coming from, Mexico and Central America. So the first permanent cap on immigration, that's significant. It also confirms that aliens ineligible to become citizens will be excluded. So it basically consolidates various restrictions against different Asian immigrant groups. And that's very significant. And then it creates a quota and a non-quota class. So I did say that there's a cap. In the non-quota class, that there's no cap to that, right? So, but at this stage, it's a fairly constrained group. So it's things like, the husbands, not the wives, but the husbands of citizens, the children of citizens, and some professional classes. So there's no limit to the number of those people who can come in. But the bulk of immigrants fall under a quota, and that's the cap we're talking about. So what's significant about 1924 is, and now I just have to add in, I know you told me to try not to get into too many weeds, but the fact that we had the 1921 Emergency Quota Act 3 years previous is important to know, because there's a shift between the 1921 and 1924 Act in terms of what the quota immigrants, who can comprise the quota immigrants. So if you'll allow me, I'll just explain that. So the 1921 Emergency Quota Act, it said that the immigrants who came in had to be a proportion of each nationality in the 1910 census, right? So that date's important, obviously, because a lot of Southern and Eastern Europeans had already arrived in the country by 1910. But by 1924, the decision is made to move that back to the 1890 census before a large number of Southern and Eastern Europeans come. So what they're doing is progressively trying to move the bar of what they want immigration to look like closer and closer to sort of the ethnic makeup of the country at its foundation. That's what they're trying to do. This is clearly deliberately targeted at Southern and Eastern Europeans because of how immigration changed between 1890 and 1910. And so what it means is, the overall cap of quota immigrants is reduced to about 164,000. 86% of those can come from Northern and Western Europe, only 12% from Southern and Eastern Europe, and a token 100 per country from anywhere else outside the Western Hemisphere. Now, do you want me to go on to, because the other important bit is...
Hit us with weeds. Come on, let's get digging.
Yeah, so here's the really important weeds. So this 2% of the 1890 census that I just mentioned was actually only temporary. What the 1924 Act also said was that it created a national origins quota system board that had to get to work to figure out a more permanent quota system. And this was going to get even further, even closer, they hoped, to the sort of ethnic makeup of the country, racial makeup of the country at its foundation. So, this was supposed to go into effect in 1927. It didn't go into effect until 1929, which tells us about how much difficulty they had in actually figuring out what to do. And so what the national quota system eventually determined was it gave an annual quota for each national group in proportion to what they call the national origin of the population in 1920. So on one hand, they said, this is much more generous, right? We're looking at the population today and we're going to allow immigrants to come in on the basis of what today's population, who's in today's population. But what they actually did was they come up with this extremely elaborate system of determining the national origins of the population based on things like the first census in 1790, which was really patchy and only really existed for certain states. They used things like they determined people's ethnicity by their last name in that 1790 census. They came up with really dubious mathematics to figure out sort of the hypothetical number of descendants from someone who was alive in, you know, 1790, that kind of thing. They also, and this is really important, they took out of their calculations the descendants of people who were born or descended from Native Americans, African slaves, and immigrants from Asia and the Western Hemisphere. So, yeah, so they're saying this is, the American population is white, is European, all of those other groups are not actually in, you know, our stock, whether that's Native or immigrant. And that clearly has a bearing on how many immigrants can come from African countries. Asian countries are excluded anyway. So that's really significant to bear in mind. And it tells us a lot about how the architects of the National Origins Quota System viewed the idea of American nationhood, belonging, everything. So what this achieves, and this is where the weeds, we come out of the weeds, this achieves is, it's similar to 1924, but it's permanent. So 83% of visas are going to go to Northwestern Europe, 15% to Southeastern Europe, and even fewer, but 2% to the rest of the world. And that's again like a token number. So it's only about 4,000 to anywhere outside of Europe. So that's where we are by the end of the 1920s. I hope we can see through all those ways and figure out those numbers. I get my policy wonk hat on me when I think about these laws. Imagine being in my classroom.
No, going into the weeds is super, super important. Detail matters. Yeah. Detail really, really matters, especially within these situations. So, thinking of what getting into the weeds of what this actually does, and does it work? Does all of this actually make the United States, for want of a better term, a whiter, more ethnically homogenous nation? Does it have the effects that the people who put it in place wanted it to have?
Yeah, so it certainly dramatically reduces immigration. And it dramatically reduces the proportion of the population who were immigrants. So, you know, the peak year of immigration is in 1907, that's 1.2 million, and we don't get anywhere near that for a long time. After that, the immigration dips during World War One, but it climbs again in 1921 up to 800,000. But then it falls way down to as low as 23,000 in 1933. So it works in terms of regulating the actual admission of people. And there's a couple of metrics that might be useful. So the proportion of English-speaking immigrants increases significantly. In 1914, about 8.8% of immigrants could speak English. And in 1924, 28.3% were English speakers. So that tells you a fair amount. And then just proportion of the population, obviously there's a lag effect, right? So, you know, the proportion of the population made up of immigrant people born abroad is at its peak in the 1890s at almost 15%. But by 1970, so there's the lag, obviously, because by 1970 the law has changed again, but you know, the lag from the 1920s is taking effect. The low point of immigrants in the population, it's 4.7. So only 4.7% of the population in 1970 are immigrants. Now, in terms of white, ethically homogenous, I'm hoping there's someone out there who, you know, understands these figures better than me, because it's very hard actually to, based on how, you know, the definition of race in the census changes so much for all sorts of reasons, political and otherwise, it's quite hard to, you know, get hard numbers on this kind of thing. But I mean, yes, like it clearly, the reduction of, immigration from other, the exclusion of immigration from parts of the world that were not European is going to have an effect. At the same time, we do see in this period, because immigration is cut off from Europe and there's going to be a labor issue there, we see an increase in immigration from Mexico, from Latin America, Mexico in particular though. That's a question of how race is going to be defined at different points in time, but that portion of the population is going to increase. But in general, I mean, the architects of the 1924 Act pretty much achieved their aim in terms of reducing the proportion of the population that were immigrants.
Mm. Sorry, just a very small follow-up, and no problem if you don't know anything about this. Is there not a point during the Great Depression in the 1930s or where there's some sort of forced deportation of Mexicans that are there as well? Like, I don't know if you know anything about that.
That's really important. They, you know, the large scale migration of Mexican laborers in particular, really starts to take off from the middle of the 20th century. But, and, you know, the history of Mexican migration into the US obviously is starting that story is a very hard thing to do, because obviously a lot of the southwest of the US was Mexico, and you know, the border was not, you know, it's not the fixed thing that we imagine it to be. But the 1930s, yes, and I think I mentioned a little while ago the liable to become a public charge clause that was brought in the late 19th century. And although migration from the Western Hemisphere was not limited in terms of a cap, at various times, the federal government applied the liable to become a public charge clause in order to control the flow of migration, especially from Mexico. And the 1930s is a good example of that. So, you know, what that says is you can't enter the country or you're sent back if you become a burden on the state. And the 1930s, they used this clause in particular. And the case that you're referring to, we've heard a lot about it in recent years, because there was, I don't have the figures to hand, but there was a significant deportation of and repatriation of Mexicans in the US, and that included a significant number of American-born children born to Mexican immigrant parents, but obviously American citizens. So that's why that case got so much attention, because of, you know, all of what's been happening with family separation and deportation today.
Cool. Thank you very much for that. So, I mean, if we leave behind the roaringly racist 20s and the 30s, and we jump forward a few decades, you know, the US has now come through the Great Depression, World War II, and it's had this new Immigration Act in place. And there, at least as I understand it, according to the narrative I've sort of heard, it's by the 1950s a more homogenous white identity that includes formerly excluded immigrants, you know, or discriminated against immigrants such as the Irish and Italians, who, you know, having fought shoulder to shoulder with WASP Americans in Europe and the Pacific, are now accepted into US society. You know, we're about to have a Catholic president for the first time in John F. Kennedy. And immigration just isn't really a hot button political issue, or at least that's the narrative. Like, is that a good summation of how things go until, you know, we're going to talk about what happens when we get to 1965? But is that sort of an accurate reflection?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. Because I'm an immigration of 20th century, or sorry, historian of 20th century immigration, I obviously want to say that immigration is always important. And I probably would sort of just question that, you know, maybe, yeah, my hot button political issues is probably something I'm sure, you know, maybe we couldn't apply specifically to this. But in this period, basically after World War II, for the reasons you've mentioned, you know, this idea of this sort of the ascendancy of middle class white ethnics, we'll call them, as they would have been called fairly frequently in the history, you know, non-Anglo names in the middle class amongst military leaders and heroes of World War II, in Congress, and of course, you know, in the White House, and eventually, you know, in Kennedy's administration, there's going to be a lot of non-Anglo, you know, names in there. That's all, it's all really important because, you know, what we see from basically after the Second World War, and definitely in the 1950s is, although maybe immigration reform isn't a hot button issue, there is a constant push to repeal the national origins quota system, in particular. And it's coming from, this group that you're talking about. It's coming from these sort of, middle class and more powerful, more educated. Of course, the, you know, the GI Bill is an important factor here. Group of, Italian Americans, Irish Americans, certainly, you know, other, Southern and Eastern European, descendants are, you know, a couple of generations removed. And, you know, obviously we don't like to say anything is inevitable in history and it's not, but, in a lot of ways, sort of the fate of the national origins quota system was kind of, you know, you can see it, in danger from fairly early on in the 1950s. One, galvanizing moment was the McCarran-Walter Act. Walter McCarran, sorry, I was mixed up the order. And that was passed in 1952. And, you know, this was a moment where there was a hope that immigration restriction or immigration policy was going to be really transformed, but it actually retained the national origins quota system. And so for those who wish to see the quota system repealed, this became the sort of lightning rod moment. And here's where I want to give us all a moment of optimism because a historian, Oscar Handlin, one of the most significant historians of US immigration, was really crucial in this sort of campaign to repeal the national origins quota system. So we should take heart that we can make that kind of a difference. Oscar Handlin, what he does is he takes the national origins quota system and he really just picks it apart, ridicules it, exposes it. He speaks on this and he writes on this. He appeared before, there was a presidential commission on immigration launched after the McCarran-Walter Act. And they issued a report called Whom We Shall Welcome. And the title of that's actually significant because it's a quote from George Washington, I think. And so it's sort of saying, like, it's the national, this is our tradition, this is our heritage to be welcoming to immigrants. So what Handlin does is he, you know, he picks apart all those methodological holes in the national origins quota system, in this really, you know, wonky, nerdy sort of way. And, he says that these figures were produced based on what he calls discredited doctrines of Anglo-Saxon Nordic superiority, not based on reliable statistics. So he says this quota system, this is not who the nation is. And so these ideas, these arguments articulated by Handlin and many others, that this was a nation of immigrants. That's another, you know, it's another term that we talked about, before we met today. That the nation is, this is a nation of immigrants, and that the past 30 years of restriction are an aberration from that heritage. That becomes a really important part of, tackling the national origins quota system and working towards, repeal. But the group that you're mentioning, are really important. This is sort of, the white ethnics who have kind of emerged into a middle class are really important. I could say a few more things about the Nation of Immigrants idea and how and the problems with it, but I don't know if you want me to get into that or not.
I wouldn't mind asking. I've got a kind of question related to about the American position in the world at the time.
Right.
Because obviously, you know, we're, you know, entering the era of, you know, the world is decolonizing. Newly independent nations in Africa and Asia and various other places. There's the era of the kind of the emerging and then solidifying contest between communism and capitalism under the rubric of the Cold War. How much is the fact that America is fighting this ideological conflict and trying to appeal to newly independent nations, how much does that affect thinking about immigration policy and what the US does to welcome or not to welcome foreign-born coming to its shores?
Definitely. I'm really glad you asked that because that's really important, and I should have mentioned that. I mean, this global context is vital. I'm sure, you know, we're all familiar with Mary Dudziak's work on Cold War and civil rights, and you know, this
one of the books that has influenced me the most being a historian.
Yeah, so I mean, there's a similar thing happening with immigration reform, and it's, you know, it's no coincidence that, you know, the three major pieces of legislation that, you know, Johnson signs are going, one of them is going to be immigration, and then Immigration Act, and then there's Civil Rights and Voting Rights Act. So these things do come together, and I would say that, you know, from the period just after World War II, when the question of what to do with refugees and displaced persons is the immigration issue in those years immediately following World War II. And that, with the sort of the beginning of the Cold War, that is a sort of a moment where those protesting for immigration reform are saying, we're supposed to be, you know, the leaders of the democratic free world. We're supposed to taking this role in on the global stage, and our civil rights, you know, later on the discussion will be that the civil rights situation with African Americans is a national shame, and so immigration reformers are going to use the same kind of logic. So the Cold War context is really important.
Okay, and we get to 1965, and, you know, Lyndon Johnson, you know, in his typical understated way when it comes to signing bills, goes to the Statue of Liberty, you know, under, you know, the giving me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses, yearn to break free, and signs the Immigration Reform Act of 1965, Hart Celler, as, you know, you said, you love calling it by the bill's name sponsors. Which, as I understand it, completely reforms the immigration system all over again. And yet, looking back in history, I feel like this almost goes entirely unnoticed. So, first of all, does it go unnoticed? And what is in this new act, and how can it have gone so much under the radar?
Yeah, so the Hart-Celler Act comes in 1965, and it's really the result of a very long process that we were just talking about of trying to get rid of the national origins quota system, but figuring out how to do that. And in ways, it reminds me of sort of, you know, figuring out how to introduce the national origins quota system to begin with. It's almost like, you know, lawmakers know what they want to achieve, but they don't know how to do it in legislative practical terms. Maybe that's lawmaking in general. I don't know. So what the Hart-Celler Act does is, you know, the important thing that LBJ wants to note is that it abolishes the national origins quota system. It abolishes the Asia Pacific triangle, right? So it removes any restrictions on immigration on the basis of race, at least, you know, at that level. It imposes a greater worldwide cap, but still a cap, right? We still have a ceiling. And again, we still have quota and non-quota classes. The other thing that it does is it imposes two separate caps for the Eastern Hemisphere and for the Western Hemisphere. That's significant because, as we mentioned already, the Western Hemisphere didn't have an overall country limit at all beforehand, or an overall cap, sorry. So there are 120,000 annual cap for migrants from the Western Hemisphere. There's no preference system, which there will be for the Eastern Hemisphere, and I'll get to that in a second. And there's no country limit, although that's going to change. So that is of major significance for migration from Mexico, which at this stage is increasing significantly. And there has been a lot of labor migration from Mexico. And what's interesting about that is that, you know, the imposition of a Western Hemisphere cap was actually a compromise to Southern Democrats who were very reluctant to sign the Hart-Celler Act, and this was one way to get them on board. It was an extra restriction.
And so in terms of the effect that this had on the United States, you know, we hear a lot about the fact that in the future the United States is going to be a majority minority country, and I can only imagine that part of the reason that this is on the road to this is because of the effects of the 1965 Act. I mean, is that true? Did it have a dramatic impact on the makeup of the ethnic makeup of the United States?
Yeah, I mean, it absolutely did. And the 1965 Act itself, and then to an extent other things that happened since, but the Hart-Celler Act was really important. So one thing I didn't mention, I forgot to mention, was in the Act, the preference system that was introduced, because this helps explain this story, it was regardless of race or national origin, but it gave 80% to family members, 20% for skills, and a small percentage to refugees. So what that means is, if you're a citizen or a permanent resident, you know, you've got, there are a lot of ways in which your family members from abroad can come into the country. So this is going to be really important because it explains a lot about the intentions of the architects of Hart-Celler, but it also explains the massive changes that resulted. So just to touch on those changes. First of all, there's a massive increase in the number of immigration. So between 1971 and 1980, we've got 4.5 million immigrants arriving per year, right? So that's a massive increase, compared to numbers even from, you know, the 1910s. A lot of family reunions, Italians and others are bringing brothers and sisters in, but a lot of that is completed by the mid 1970s. So the major significance is the composition of the immigration, after 1965, because it is, majority from Asia, Mexico, Latin America, and also Africa, as sort of we get towards the end of the 20th century, this is in the 1990s, Asian migration is extremely significant. So between 1960 and 64, only about 42.6% of the total come from sort of outside of Europe. But by the 1970s, 75% of the total are coming from outside of Europe. And I think it's really important to note how unintended these consequences were. And this gets back to, you know, Johnson's sort of, this is really significant, but it's also not going to make a big difference comments at the Statue of Liberty. Because we know this because, legislators on the floor of Congress themselves were saying this isn't going to create a lot of change. Hart-Celler was really about righting a perceived wrong in the past, which was the national origins quota system. And yes, it was, you know, in part designed to allow reunification of the likes of Italian families, but it was really about how Americans of various ethnicities and races felt about their place in society. So it was about Americans as much, if not more, than it was about future immigrants. I can't remember the historian who said this, but it's the national origins quota system was seen as a proxy for the status of those Americans. So this was the intention, was that if we base the law around family reunification, we're going to basically shore up the existing sort of ethnic makeup. And we're not going to get a big increase of immigrants because once those families are reunified, that's done. But what they don't expect is that, this underestimates that by opening up immigration to the world, skilled immigrants are going to be coming in, and they're then going to bring in their family members also. And this is where we see a large increase of migration from Asia. So this is where sort of the transformation was massive and the intentions were totally unintended, sort of consequences. Everyone from Robert Kennedy to Edward Kennedy to Emmanuel Seller, one of the acts, sort of they gave his name to the act. They all said, you know, the ethnic mix of this country will not be upset. We won't have many immigrants from Africa or Asia, and that proved to be mostly wrong. So,
and one element of the kind of narrative on, you know, 1965 and these, you know, changes in US law was that it's the result of years of lobbying and campaigning by ethnic groups and religious organizations. So with a particular focus on religious organizations, what extent is that actually true in terms of getting this change in the law passed?
Yeah, so this is the focus of my research. So I would like to argue that was absolutely true. I focused on Catholic organizations, Catholic individuals, mainly working within the National Catholic Welfare Conference, which is, you know, the forerunner to today's USCCB, the Conference of Catholic Bishops. I've looked at Catholic, we'll call them lobbyists. They couldn't really call themselves lobbyists because there are sort of legal issues around that. But, you know, I know from my work that there was a huge amount of work going on amongst Protestant organizations, Jewish groups in particular, the Anti-Defamation League of Nybrith were really active on this, as on many issues of sort of racial equality and discrimination, in American life. So, you know, my argument for this would be that it's a long process. And for Catholics, if I could sort of talk about the Catholic people that I write about in particular, really from the end of the First World War, when we see the introduction of the immigration restrictions of the 1920s, Catholic agencies are beginning to establish themselves physically in Washington DC, as lobbying groups. They're paying attention to changes in immigration law, and they are constantly appearing before congressional committees. They're more so after the Second World War, they're beginning to work together, initially on the refugee issue. They're working with other religious groups. For Catholics, they're pushing for family unity is crucial, because they're basing their criticism of immigration law on Catholic social thought, which sees the family as the core unit of a stable society. And so they're pushing for changes in the law that will allow, for example, in the 1920s, Italian male immigrants whose wives and children are still in Italy to bring those family members in, that kind of thing. But they're also pushing for things like an end to the Bracero program, because of how it breaks up families between Mexico and the US. By the time we get to the 60s, I'll just say with the 1950s, I mentioned Oscar Handlin and that sort of movement to undermine the national origins quota system. And a lot of these Catholic agencies, Protestant and Jewish, are really supporting that message, the removal of the national origins quota system. And then by the time we get to the Johnson administration and their work on, you know, pushing forward, which takes a couple of years, right, to push forward with the Hart-Celler Act. What Johnson actually does is they bring in a sort of interreligious committee. There are other non-religious agencies involved too. They come to the White House, and I would argue that they're not actually affecting change to the act, to the bill that's being proposed, because they're largely happy with it. But they're sort of brought in to give this new immigration proposal and status quo their imprimatur, to give it their sort of blessing. And because of the place of, you know, of religion in American life at this point in the 20th century, that really, I would argue that's a really valuable blessing to give to this significant immigration law.
I mean, it is an interesting moment, this post-war period for American Catholics. Given the, on one hand we have, anti-communism becomes something that in some ways allows Catholicism to kind of enter the cultural and political mainstream of American life in a way that they'd not really been permitted to before. Is immigration another strand of that kind of like Catholic involvement with American political, cultural and social life in kind of new ways? And have American Catholics always been critical of immigration policy?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's one place where they're able to, you know, assert a voice on an issue that affects the entire nation, not just, you know, American Catholics. So I think that's really significant. In terms of were they always critical, so what I've traced is I've gone back really to sort of the 1910s. Obviously, I've gone into the 19th century to have context, and it's really in the 1910s that we start to see a sort of more organized, sorry, I wouldn't say the 1910s, I'd say after the First World War, a more organized response to immigration policy. Now, to say that they're critical, what the moment that actually piqued my interest in this aspect, in this Catholic interpretation of immigration law, was actually a case where a prominent Catholic was in favor of immigration restriction. This was John Ryan, Monsignor John Ryan, who was the leading Catholic social theorist of the first half of the 20th century. And John Ryan is most known for his work on the living wage. And his argument was that he supported the Literacy Test Act because he took the same position as organized labor did on it. He said that the influx of unskilled immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe was affecting American wages, and that was affecting their moral and material well-being of American citizens and existing immigrants, and therefore immigration should be restricted. So that was the sort of moment that got me really interested in this topic. And what I would say is, from that point up until today, Catholic thought on immigration has always had a strain of restriction in it, which might sound surprising today. So the argument they would make is that the individual has the right to migrate, to find a living wage, to find a place for their family to live in peace and security, but that the state, the nation state, has a right to control and a responsibility to control migration in the national interest. So there's always been these two things. And so we see this tension coming up at different moments. In 1952, there was disagreement over whether or not to support the McCarran-Walter Act, in part because of that tension. It's a question of emphases, I think, at different points in history for them. And we see a bit of that tension today in the Catholic position on immigration. But because of the virulence of anti-immigrant sentiment, I think Catholic voices today are much more on the liberal side, because I think, they feel that they have to be, because the stakes are so much higher. Or, well, not that they're so much higher, they've always been high, but that the nature of the debate today sort of forces that, I think.
Okay, so to kind of round off with a question to throw forward to today's cheery present.
Start with the easy one.
Yeah, exactly. So, and conservative hero Ronald Reagan's farewell address, the Gipper, as he was called, celebrated immigration as a real strength of the United States, a key part of his whole idea of America's shining city upon a hill. And yet we now have a Republican president who, this isn't an interpretation, he is openly hostile to many groups of immigrants. And I also remember even a real eye-opener for me back in 2012 when Republican presidential candidate Rick Perry was booed because he'd had the gall while Texas governor to allow immigrant children to be educated in some way. And it feels like there's some huge shift going on in American politics, because back in the 1980s, the Democrats were perhaps the more restrictive on immigration for reasons of labor. So I guess my big broad question is here, how did we get here? Where we've got this one political party now that's so openly hostile to immigration that used to celebrate it and now controls most of the levers of power in politics. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in 2 minutes. So I think, one of the sort of strands of how we got here lies in, what we were just saying about the effects of 1965 is the massive demographic changes that it had, that ushered in, and that, some subsequent, legislative moves helped solidify, and this shift away from a, white majority nation has an effect. And the case you're talking about with Rick Perry, it was citizens and voters who were cheering for him, and this idea of both political parties being aware of who's going to be voting for them has such an important effect on their positions on immigration today, right? So in the case of the Republicans, there's especially under Trump, and I'm going to draw a distinction in a second, but there's the sense that, well, we're going to tap into fears about these demographic changes and fears about the rate of immigration. And on the part of the Democrats, there's a sense that, well, we want these immigrants to vote for us, and people, Hispanic Americans and others who are of more recent immigrant stock, we want them to vote for us. So that's obviously in the forefront of their minds. But I also think, I guess, one caveat I would put in here is it's really important to note that, you know, neither party has been shy about immigration control, even up until more recent years. And I think that there's a distinction between, I guess we maybe touched on this a little bit earlier, there's a distinction between anti-immigrant law and anti-immigrant sentiment and, you know, how the latter is harnessed for in favor of the former. If we look back at, you know, what both parties were doing through the 1970s, 1980s, you know, IRCA, the Immigration Reform Control Act, was obviously brought in by Reagan. It legalizes the undocumented, right? And this amnesty is what we always hear about today in terms of, that's the contrast you're drawing, right? Between Reagan and Trump. Like, we can't imagine that happening today. But it also brought, the IRCA Act also brought in sanctions against employers who knowingly hired undocumented immigrants, right? So there's your carrot and stick. The Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act of 1996 under Clinton, this expanded funding for the INS, right? For immigration infrastructure and for a border fence. And we've had bipartisanship earlier in the 21st century that where both parties agree on border control. But I think one of the major differences, and it's become so much more stark under Trump than it was under, say, George W. Bush, is in how immigrants are treated within the United States. And, you know, if we think about things like, SB 1040, was it, in Arizona, that was brought in, that allows the police to stop and ask people for their papers based on how they look, right? So that's obviously ethnic profiling. These changes, and, you know, the Rick Perry and the Education of Immigrant Children, undocumented immigrant children, probably, these changes are things where I think, you know, the parties are obviously on quite different pages. And as I said, it's become so much more stark under Trump. I hope that gets at your question. I guess my short answer would be that, you know, neither party has been shy about immigration restriction in sort of terms of controlling the borders, but it's how that's done that is the vast difference.
Cool. Well, thank you very much for that, which, you know, performing that Herculean task from taking us all the way from the days of the melting pot through to, I don't really know what to call these days, we'll let future historians name them, they'll be able to have far more perspective on it than I can at this stage. But thank you so much for joining us, Gráinne.
Thank you very much, I've really enjoyed it, and it's lovely to talk to a Scottish audience as well.
and a fellow graduate of the American Institute of Course, Edinburgh as well. to listeners, we are going to be back before Christmas with another podcast, so keep an eye out for that. But until then, thank you as well, Malcolm. Always a pleasure, never a chore.
Thank you very much, and thank you to Gráinne as well.
Yep, and we'll hear from you again soon. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Be lovers, we'll marry our fortunes together. I've got some real estate here in my bag, so we bought a pack of cigarettes, and this is where the pies, and walked off to look for a man. I said as we boarded a Greyhound in Pittsburgh, Michigan seems like a dream to me now. It took me 4 days to hitchhike from Saginaw. I've come to look for America. Laughing on the bus, playing games with the faces.